Thanks, Barbara. I wanted to follow up on one thing, and Lynn had said something which I just wanted to, again, Wayne, go back to the comment you made, just so I understand the point again, because it wasn't clear to me yet. Making a distinction between management and supervisory personnel, and I think Lynn had talked about, you know, going right to the top of the organization, the person who sets the tone at the top. I guess that could be management, the CEO of the firm, and his responsibility could be P&L. You know, just for instance, you know, just is in charge of the profitability of the firm. But that still could have a supervisory aspect with respect to the partners who lead the practice in auditing in terms of their behavior with respect to audit quality or sufficiency if they felt they had to deliver profits at a cost of getting all the work done potentially. So is there a distinction that maybe I'm still missing?
Yeah, it wasn't so much the position that the person has, but the responsibilities that the person has. So, you know, that same person could have management responsibilities and supervisory responsibilities, and some of the what that person perceives as management responsibilities can have an indirect association to the quality of the audit when it comes to hiring personnel, for example, with a background that Barbara had mentioned.
Doug Anderson.
I only just had a quick comment. I'm kind of torn on this one because, in general, I don't like overly prescriptive standards or rules. And in that sense, if it comes to the question of having a specific, it's either detailed standard or general standard, I'd lean towards a general standard so you don't end up with a checklist standard, which doesn't require auditors to use good judgment. But I wanted to follow up on something Steve had mentioned, and as I got thinking about this during the discussion here, this is a pretty broad topic as to failure to supervise. And if one of the motivations behind this effort is because of the results of the inspection process, I'd encourage the PCAOB to find a way to get something like the report that we talked about yesterday on what we saw in the inspections on the audit firms dealing with the economic crisis. If this is a big enough issue, it's driving potential rulemaking. If we could get more clarity on the specific kinds of things that we're seeing in the inspections, what part of that broad spectrum of fail to supervise are you seeing? That might help not only guide the rulemaking process, but guide all the firms to know where they should be worrying about or concerned about the weakness areas that are in other firms that may be infecting their firm.
Thank you, Doug. One of the things the concept release also seeks comment on are the potential unintended consequences if a board were to go down a path of potential rulemaking in this area, and that's broad to either the general or the specific approach. Wanted to pose this question to the SAG in case you had any thoughts about any potential unintended consequences. Barbara Roper?
The only thing I'd say briefly is, and the reason I think it's important to, as I say, to follow the chain of responsibility up the ladder is that if you're within a firm, this is common in the broker-dealer world, which is the primary area where I dealt with this. As I said, in the large firm report, more than 80% of the violations were in one company. So if you're in a company that compensates and promotes and does evaluations and everything to encourage an approach that's not in the investor interest, the fact that there's a person named on a chart as being responsible for one particular area shouldn't leave them holding the bag for what's created, a culture that's created within the corporation. And so I think I don't see this as a downside to having failure to supervise responsibility. I think it's a caution to make sure that in developing that, it goes all the way to up the ladder.
Thank you, Barbara. Bill Gradison.
For the record, the largest monetary sanction that has ever been imposed by this board so far was in connection with a failure to supervise was $1 million, and it was levied against one of the biggest firms. I only mention that because some of the discussion a little while ago might have given the impression that nothing is going on in the enforcement area with regard to failure to supervise. At least there was that one back in December of 2008. And that does lead me to a question. In view of that enforcement action, which is public information, what would a rule add that beyond the precedent already set by that sanction?
I think what the board's release tries to make clear that rules is not necessarily necessary to impose sanctions for failure to supervise. And I think in the case you're referring to wasn't even under 105C6, but related to specific failures to do things required cited in the standards. So there's no obstacle. You're absolutely right. There's no obstacle to the board bringing more enforcement actions like that. The point of the type of rule we're talking about today would be to see whether there are ways that a rule could supplement that authority, could be helpful both to the board in identifying where responsibility lies for failure, and also by increasing accountability through the same mechanism to actually increase the quality of supervision and increase the quality of audits.
Doug Anderson? Well, then Lynn Turner.
Bill, on that particular case, that fine, and I'm sure the firm considered it serious, but that fine was half of 1% of that firm's revenues. I don't know that I consider that something that is really going to shake people up and take notice. It's almost like a cost of operation. I think if you want to get serious about what is if you see a case and if you thought it was all that serious, a fine of that magnitude may not get it done. The law specifically says you could have fined up to $15 million, and you chose instead to fine less than 10% of what you are allowed to under the law to fine. There's another message that could be sent by that as well, and that is, you didn't think it was that significant or that serious, or you would have used a much higher fine. So I do think coming back and sending a stronger message in the enforcement cases would be helpful. I personally think that, to your point, I think that'll probably do better than a rule. By God, if you need to go back and tell people one more time, they really need to do their jobs as partners and get it done. There's nothing like a good old-fashioned $15 million enforcement case and find that audit partner up to the full max you can of $750,000 per occurrence. You take, a whack at a partner's personal pocketbook. And personally, in these cases, I think in most of these cases, we're going to find had nothing to do with the national office, had nothing to do with the CEO at the top. It was essentially down at the individual partner where they didn't perform in accordance with the firm standards. That's been my experience. It hadn't been a firm-wide failure to supervise. It's been on down with that individual partner. And there's nothing like taking those out, and if you found one that failed to supervise on, say, three situations, go find them $2 million. That'll do more good than any rule you can ever write. But you got to get serious about the fine. Half of 1%, and less than 10% of what you could have fined the firm doesn't send a strong message.
Thank you, Lynn. Barbara Roper.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to remember that the rule you're talking about here is not to restate the obligation to supervise. The rule that you're talking about is to fully and carefully document where the obligation to supervise resides in different areas. And what that adds beyond enforcement is clarity. You know, we eliminate any ambiguity about where the, and it gives you something to inspect against, because, you know, strong as we are in supporting enforcement, we like to avoid the situations where we need enforcement as the response. And you have a great mechanism through the inspection and required remediation to correct problems before they blow up into something where we'd want an enforcement action as a result. And so I think something that provides clarity in terms of documenting throughout, you know, the various different possible complex areas where the line of responsibility lies, gives the board something to inspect against that has the potential to strengthen those supervisory practices within the firms, particularly in the areas where they're not as clearly defined as they may be within the context of a particular audit. And then I would add, you know, about this notion that it's generally the audit partner. You know, I'm not sure the Arthur Andersen case actually supports that. That notion, you know, my memory's getting a little hazy, but as I recall on the Enron audit, there was a meeting with the risk committee within the firm in which the partners came in and identified, carefully walked through all of the risks associated with audit and all of the concerns about the accounting that they were presenting, and, you know, and then everybody found a way to get comfortable with that situation. Well, in that case, it's not just the partner who's doing the audit, although obviously they have a clear responsibility, but it's the other people within the firm who enabled that conduct. And so I do think that taking those supervision obligations beyond the sort of narrow construct of the audit, in which I think they're fairly clearly understood, into this broader issue of the management and operation of the firm is important. Jim Cox?
I wonder if a byproduct of identifying, being specific where the duty resides, would also come up in the context of the minimizing the opportunities for being second-guessed by the SEC in its evaluation about whether the enforcement action is appropriate or not. So I just wonder if that clarity on that front wouldn't be helpful as well.
And Lynn Turner?
Yeah, I don't want to oppose rules. I think some guidance here is helpful, including at the top. Barb is right about Enron. Xerox had top people at the right up to the CEO of the firm involved in that situation. Again, people at the senior level at Parmalat, including in the general counsel's office, were involved with those decisions. The court documents all clearly show that and establish that. So having the guidance that Barb talked about who's responsible, so you got something to inspect against and hold people accountable, that is clear, I think is fine. But then, unless you hold them accountable for what you write, it won't matter. So go get yourself some good general guidance that you inspect and hold them accountable against if you don't think what is out there now is adequate. And that's what's showing. But then you've also got to come through with some serious enforcement, or the rule means nothing.
Dan?
Maybe just a clarification, and Michael, if you think I'm off track here, tell me. But Bill raised the case where we have an action against the firm, and then in that case there's also an action against the engagement partner on the particular engagement. The theory against the firm is that they hadn't complied with the QC obligations to staff that engagement properly because of problems they were aware of with respect to the partner. And I think in that kind of case, people might ask, weren't there other individuals at the firm beyond the engagement partner who had some responsibility to make sure that those QC requirements were operating. But it is, speaking of that case particularly, it's difficult often to identify who those people are in a way that is really can serve as a basis for an enforcement action. So that's the reason for this concept release, to ask, should we make the firms define for us in advance who has these responsibilities, so that if something, you know, falls apart, something goes wrong, we can identify the people who are responsible above the engagement level for the fact that the particular QC requirements didn't operate or weren't enforced or whatever. So I'm just kind of responding to your point, Lynn. You can argue about the size of the fine and maybe the case should have been done differently, but what this proposal aims at is, well, are there other people in the firm hierarchy that should also be held responsible, and how do we identify those people?
And if you lay that out, I think that's fine, Dan. I'm a little bit surprised that people are coming back to you, and maybe the firms around the table could respond to this, but I'm surprised that they would come back to you and say, we don't know who's responsible for supervising that partner and the quality on that audit. Obviously, you've got a concurring partner on each audit that's involved. And then you've got, whenever I've seen it, there's been a very clear delineation of who the partners report up to, and they may report up to a couple people depending upon the situation. But I think if people are saying we don't know who's supervising in the firm, we've got a huge problem. You know, if a firm's giving you that answer, right, you got a much bigger problem, and $1 million doesn't touch that problem. I mean, but that's what I'm hearing you're saying. You're saying that in these audits, people at the firm are coming back and telling you, we can't tell who was responsible for overseeing the audit partner and quality on a particular audit. And I find that very disconcerting, and I'd like to hear the response of the other six firms around the table as to whether or not they really think in their firms they can't tell you who's responsible for overseeing the audit partner and supervising to make sure there's quality on an audit.
Sam Renzillo?
Just thinking about putting it up, but I guess I do now. Thanks, Bella.
You have to actually thank John White, who complained yesterday that he didn't get a chance to make a comment because I wasn't fast enough.
Two of my favorite people. Lynn, I'm not sure what you mean by supervise the audit partner. I think that there are certain aspects of engagement overall. So if we're going to take this from engagement quality now and individual engagement quality and map that up against the QC standards, I would say there are a number of different people that touch certain aspects of that engagement to assure, to provide reasonable assurance that the team overall complies with the standards. And I'm not trying to be cute, but there's a particular individual or individuals that might say, this is the right person for engagement X because they've got the right skill set, they've, you know, whatever criteria you go through. There might be other people in conjunction with that that also says client X is a client that we're willing to accept or continue to perform as their auditors. There might be another individual that is responsible for the first line of consultation with respect to a technical issue. So you get the client in the door, you get the right people on it, and then you've got a question, and you say, okay, well, how is the QC system designed so that if there are consultations, it gets to the right place. And each firm has a different structure, whether it's regional, or, you know, local, national. But you need that, right? So that the engagement partner says, I know where to go for a particular issue. Is there one I don't think there is just one person lined up in our firm to deal with each engagement partner. I think there are steps in the quality control system that are designed to have oversight at probably multiple levels. I don't know if that helps or not.
No, it does, Sam, but I think back to the question that Bill raised, which was a very valid and good question, I think what you just said absolutely and very strongly makes the case for Marty and his staff to move forward with rulemaking, because I think that notion of that broader level of supervision does need to be defined and encompassed in what the rules define as supervision, as Dan just said, because I don't think when I read through the current quality control rules, they're even close to being that broad or really address very adequately that situation. So I think, given what you just said, I think it makes an extremely strong case for the board to move ahead with rulemaking and define it in that broader context. It's not a narrow context whatsoever then.
Mike Gallagher?
Yeah, just picking up on what Sam said, you know, it really is fact dependent, right? On if you have a bust, you know, some cases it's the audit partner didn't perform, and every piece of the system may have functioned perfectly, but that audit partner didn't perform. So maybe getting back to unintended consequences, that, you know, while you certainly should pry apart what happened, and if the implications, you know, go beyond the audit partner, you know, to some of the things that Sam talked about, you know, did you have a partner that was overloaded, or you had a partner that didn't have the right experience? Well, how did that partner find him or herself on that engagement? Right? How did they come to be? Did they get the right support from a concurring partner? I think those are reasonable questions to ask, but sometimes it just falls to the partner and a lack of performance. So, you know, the only caution I have in this whole thing, because I'm not troubled, quite frankly, about the standard. I think you probably have the authority under what exists today, but if you want to add it, I think that's fine. I would also opt for the more general rather than the specific, because I think it will be more scalable. But, you know, my only caution is not every single failure goes beyond the audit partner. And so this hopefully won't be an effort to let's see how many scalps we can get at the firms every time something goes wrong.
Michael, I think I'm going to have the same question Dan had. Stop me when I'm wrong. But I don't think we're saying that it would necessarily go above the partner when something went wrong if people above the partner did not fail to supervise reasonably. So you'd go beyond them if they failed to supervise reasonably, if they knew that there was a defect in the partner's skill set, for instance, as opposed to the situation where he or she was perfectly suited for the engagement, but quite frankly, to nobody's knowledge, he just didn't do what was expected of him or her. Is that fair? Thanks.
Sam Renzillo?
Again, I was trying to answer Lynn's question. But I, you know, as to my own view, I think we're supportive of your. Well, we are. I am. I am supportive of the objective that you're trying to achieve. I'm also would support a more general approach as opposed to the detailed approach. The only question I have is, it seems to me that this ought to be baked in to what you're doing on the QC. Element and should be a part of that rulemaking and not necessarily separate rulemaking, although I guess I appreciate, maybe I don't appreciate, but there might be some piece of it that gets into rules versus the QC standards And it may be different elements of the rules, but it would seem to me that it all ought to be done in conjunction with your current project on QC.
They're certainly related.
Arch?
Some of the discussion raised a question in my mind in terms of, you know, what do you mean by supervisory person? Because is somebody that is involved with responding to a consultation, as Sam was reflecting there, is that considered to be a supervisor of the engagement partner? And I think it may go back to something that Wayne was referring to, because there are a lot of people that touch engagements from the time they start coming in the door until reports go out. And which of those individuals are viewed as supervisory personnel? It's not like the partner. I mean, you have a big difference at the partner's level versus a partner supervising the work of the staff, because there's such a broad range of issues that can come up. So that might be something to take a look at in terms of clarity of definitions.
Sarge will consider that. Galen Hansen.
Yeah, I'd like to basically agree with Sam. I think that this does need to be baked into the QC standards, but if you recall, and going back to our conversation yesterday, if that's the case, then there needs to be some minimum standards within the QC guidelines, not just, you know, broad guidance, you should do this, you should do that, but not really a requirement to do anything. There has to be some minimum QC standards. And then as to Arch's comments a minute ago, what do you mean by supervising? And a lot of people touch these engagements. I absolutely believe that. There's instances where maybe it's not a technical auditing or accounting matter, but it could even be independence. So who is signed off on independence if it's a complex technical issue? And these firms, I mean, internally, they know who's responsible within the organization, and there are those lines of authority and so forth. Those have to be documented somehow in the QC document as to what, you know, who says this is okay. And if that's addressed in the QC document, it shouldn't be all that tough to identify who is responsible. But the problem with all of this, I think, is getting back to the unintended consequences, because if what you could do is really set yourself up for somebody trying to obfuscate or blur those lines of authority so that it is not clear.
Thank you very much, Galen. And thank you, everyone on the SAG, for your very thoughtful comments. I have to say that, Steve Harris, would you like to make a statement?
We've heard from both Steve and Doug in terms of what we're actually finding. And I think we probably should take that under advisement and figure out, you know, how to get back to you. I mentioned in my statement that this comes up in virtually a significant volume of the inspection reports that I've read. And therefore, from my perspective, whether it's a remediation issue, an enforcement issue, it's clearly a clarity issue, because the message has not been received by the firms, or for that matter, potentially by our inspection staff. But they are finding problems in this area which go beyond a simple enforcement. So I think it is incumbent upon us to consider the approaches that you've outlined. I think there may be a consensus, although I may be overreaching it, there ought to be a general approach as opposed to a specific detailed approach. But then I think we may have a responsibility to get back to Steve the issue that you raised, so that you know exactly, you know, in more detail with certain parameters what we're finding. But as I say, I think this is an extremely important initiative, because of the sheer volume of inspection reports that mention this issue, and it's mentioned year after year after year without successful remediation. So there is a gap in terms of what we're finding and the lack of action. So I applaud your bringing this up today and, you know, look forward to our moving it.
Thank you, Steve. Steve Fafferty, did you have?
Yeah, I would like to say, first of all, I agree it's a very important topic that should be discussed and dealt with, but I still question whether it is a policy or rule issue or an execution issue. And I think there may be times when inspection, if you are truly going out to do inspections and people are saying, I didn't know this was my responsibility, you may well want to challenge the validity of that assertion, because I do find it very difficult, and just from my own experience in our firm and in peer reviews, to believe that in most cases engagement teams particularly don't know precisely what their responsibilities are, which makes me question whether it's an execution versus a clarity issue. The other thing would be that if it is a clarity issue and it's that widespread, I agree, maybe rulemaking is the way to go. But in your document here that you wrote, you said it would facilitate the board's assessment through the inspection process of a firm's supervisory practices. It would seem to me that if you truly can't, in the inspection process, determine what those practices are, and the firm can't articulate that, then that would in fact be an inspection finding that would require remediation, and you could resolve a lot of these issues that way. But again, if it were truly widespread, then maybe rulemaking would be necessary.
Thank you, Steve. Steve Harris, did you have any other thoughts? No. Well, thank you very much for all of your thoughtful commentary. We'll take that under advisement, and also wanted to point out that if there's any additional thoughts that people around the table have or those listening to the webcast, the comment period is still open until November 3rd, and we encourage you to submit a comment letter because we really want to figure out what the best approach is and for the staff to analyze the comments we received today, the ones that will come in by November 3rd and present a balanced view to the board for their consideration. And now I'll turn it over to Marty for the next discussion topic.
Thanks, Michael, and thanks, Bella. And I echo Bella's thought. Thanks, everybody, for your thoughts on that subject. Well, we're coming down to our final subject of the day, and that is we posed a new standard with respect to confirmations. The comment period on that is closed, and we've received so many comments. And I've asked Dee Miranda Gould to present a summary of the comments received, as we've been doing recently on other proposed standard-setting initiatives. So, Dee, you've got the final position.
Not working. Thanks, Marty. So as Marty said, we proposed a standard on confirmation, and the comment period ended September 13. And before I talk about some of the key themes in the comment letters that we received, just wanted to go through some of the key requirements, remind you of some of the key requirements that are in this proposed standard. So there's a lot of words on this slide, so it's a little hard to read, but we'll go through a little bit of the background on it. There is a requirement to confirm receivables. We broadened the terminology so it includes receivables that arise from credit sales, loans, or other transactions. That terminology is found actually in FASB codification. It also includes a should confirm receivables. And that establishes a presumptively mandatory requirement to confirm receivables. And under the board's Rule 3101, the auditor must comply with requirements of this type unless the auditor demonstrates that alternative actions he or she followed in the circumstances were sufficient to achieve the objective of the standard. So thus, this includes, the proposed standard does not include a discussion of the exceptions to confirming receivables that were in the existing standard. The proposed standard also includes a requirement to confirm cash with financial institutions. and it includes a requirement to confirm other relationships with those financial institutions, including lines of credit, compensating balances, contingent liabilities, including guarantees, and the like. It includes a requirement to confirm significant risks or in response to significant risks, but it discusses the fact that confirmation might not be appropriate for all significant risks because its confirmation should be performed for those significant risks that relate to relevant assertions that can be adequately addressed by confirmation procedures. So the release is clear that we understand that not all significant risks will be able to be confirmed. The proposed standard includes requirements around maintaining control consistent with the existing requirement, but there are also some new requirements there. So, for example, it includes a requirement to perform procedures to determine the validity of addresses on confirmation requests. It also includes a requirement around management's requests not to confirm accounts and actions the auditor should consider to evaluate the implications of those requests. The proposed standard also includes a requirement for the auditor to evaluate the audit evidence. Now, that also was in the existing standard, but this proposed standard goes a little bit further in that it requires the auditor to perform alternative procedures for all non-responses. It includes requirements for the auditor to investigate each exception on a confirmation response, to assess the reliability of all confirmation responses, to evaluate the effect of disclaimers or restrictive language on the reliability of the confirmation process. As we've heard, the inclusion of disclaimers and restrictive language in confirmation responses has increased over time. We received 27 comments on the proposed standard, and the breakdown of the respondents is shown on this slide, so predominantly from accounting firms and association of accountants. And some of the key themes here, we generally received support for continuing to pursue a new standard to replace the existing standard. And primarily that support came from the fact that there have been advances in electronic communication that weren't dealt with under the existing standard. Some of the other things we heard from respondents are that we should consider modifying the standards to be more principles-based, risk-based, more consistent with the risk assessment standards. The board's encouraged to consider additional outreach to learn how the additional confirmation requirements will affect confirming parties. So the standard includes a number of requirements for auditors, but there is no ability to require confirming parties to actually respond to those confirmation requests. So we have been encouraged to consider outreach to understand that process to see if we can encourage better responses from confirming parties. A couple of other areas, we've received comments on the presumption to confirm receivables and the concern that we didn't include a statement about when exceptions are appropriate. And that's why I mentioned Rule 3101, because that covers, the should covers any possible exceptions. So there is no need to discuss exceptions in the standard. The other area was having the standard discuss any limitations on the use of internal audit or refer to the relevant auditing standard, AU Section 322. So there was some concern that we were planning to change practice and limit the use of internal audit. And other commenters mentioned that we should have more clear requirements, discussion of the intent related to internal audit and the standard. So I open it up if anybody has any thoughts or comments about the comment letters we received at this point. Doug Anderson?
Okay, I'll jump in first this time, maybe in part because I was part of the group that drafted one of those comment letters. Two things I wanted to say. One was I think I expressed a year ago when SAG talked about this the last year. I still believe this is a great example of a rule that's overly prescriptive in how it's structured. I think that, you know, the way paragraphs 8 and 9 are stated brings focus to two elements, receivables and cash. I love paragraphs 10 and 11 that talks about specific risks and talking about really focusing on the risk. And I know I have seen situations where receivable and cash are not the primary risk areas. And I think we fall into a trap with this. If we start off the discussion saying, think about receivables and cash, and oh, by the way, if there's other good risks out there, address those too, puts it backwards. I think it should be stated, look at your risks and look at confirmations as a fabulous way to potentially get audit evidence. Base it on the risks of the situation, and two areas you want to give special consideration to are receivables and cash would be structured more appropriately around the risk of the environment. And then, of course, being an internal auditor or recently having been one, I'll just echo the comments you made at the end, Dee, about the use of internal audit. I think, again, there, the way that the current wording is interpreted back in page 20 of the release, basically putting severe limitations around internal audit and how it can be used, again, may not be respective of the environment within a specic company. And I'd rather go back and just rely on 322. The way I'm worried if it's written now, and especially in the introduction to the standard, it's written now, it would be interpreted to have a different approach than what we have in the standard right now in the use of internal audit.
Dee, I'd like to respond to Doug's point about, we had 2 points, one about being overly prescriptive and then internal audit, so I'll start with overly prescriptive. When we were developing the standard, I'm kind of thinking about Sam's comments about principles-based or rules-based, and the reality is it's a combination of both, and also Marty's comments yesterday about all our standards, as we're developing, consider the risk of fraud. This standard, certainly, as we were developing it, was in considering the risk of fraud. Certainly, the requirement to confirm receivables to begin with came from a very significant fraud case, McKesson Robbins. And we even had discussion this morning about the concern about overstatement of revenue. So we had expanded the requirement there. Cash has also been an area where there's been alleged frauds regarding cash and even confirmation process. And even in the area of significant risks, our current standard today requires the auditor to at least, consider confirming things like significant or unusual complex terms, bill and hold arrangements, other things. Things that, in our view, would fall under the category of significant risk for which it would be appropriate to confirm. So the confirmations, and oftentimes confirmations are used to get information, to identify frauds, whether maybe falsification of revenue. So for all those reasons, that was really driving our thinking about what to confirm. Plus, most of the firms today, if they don't explicitly require, they strongly encourage confirmation of cash. So that led to our thinking in developing the standard, and the procedures around it go to consider fraud risk factors, testing the validity of addresses. Say the auditor is just not relying on what the company is giving them for where the companies are located, because it could be one of their best friends, or making sure the auditor sends and receives. And then, so that was our perspective, and hopefully that helps as far as the standard and how we viewed it. The other thing on internal audit, what Doug is referring to in the release, we indicated that auditors could use internal auditors. However, in our view, and as we've indicated in the standard, when auditors send and receive confirmations, they shouldn't rely on the company or any other party. In our view, that included internal audit, because in our view, you're giving up control if I've given it to someone else. I've lost maintaining control over that process. Or even evaluating responses, we thought that was so important for the auditors. We did get comments saying, well, you should just go with 322 and allow that to continue. And be interested if you had any other thoughts on why internal auditors, why you think it's appropriate for them to send confirmations on behalf of the auditor, how the auditor would still maintain control in that process.
Yeah, just on those two thoughts. The first one, I'm not saying the confirmations receivable and cash are not good. Don't get me wrong. It comes into looking at this instead of relying on issues from a big issue from a couple of decades ago to drive how this standard is structured. I think the primary focus always needs to be on auditors need to focus on risk. And we need to have a singular focus on risk, and we need to look at confirmations, respond to that, and then see how to apply that thinking. This standard is structured today. Number one thought, beat up on receivables. Well, that may not be the number one thought. So it's not that I think confirmation receivables is wrong. I think it basically just sends the wrong message that maybe a not-so-smart auditor says, if I deal with receivables and I deal with cash, I must have the big things covered. Well, they may have missed the entire big risk areas of a company. So it's a question of emphasis and how it's structured and packaged is what I take issue with. I think it should be more focused on audit risk and designing confirmations for those high-risk areas, not necessarily presume that those will always be receivables and cash with zero balances, as the standard is basically implying now. And then back to the internal audit. I mean, I've seen a lot of different internal audit functions, and there are some great internal audit functions, and there are some really poor internal audit functions. And I think I'm pretty comfortable allowing the public accountant, the external auditor, assess and evaluate the strengths and the weaknesses of the internal audit functions, their objectivity, the way that they operate, as kind of guided by the current standard to decide how best to use internal audit in those circumstances. It may very well be a case that confirmations are dealing with a medium or lower risk area. They still think it's an effective method, but in that risk profile, they're willing to take the situation that they think internal audit is objective, will do it objectively and do it professionally, and they go with that judgment. Right now, the way the standard and the release seems to be worded, you've said there will never be a situation where an internal audit could competently mail out some envelopes. And I'm not sure in every situation, every risk profile for every company with every internal auditor, that's the right answer. So I would leave it up more to the judgment of the auditor. That's just how I react to what I read.
Well, and that was in there. Internal audit is considered by auditors in two ways. One is internal audit can do their own work. They may go ahead and send their own confirmations and do tests, and auditors may consider that, reduce the nature, time, and extent of their procedures. So that part of it remains the same. The other thing is they may decide to reduce the nature, time, and extent of their procedures, say, based on the work of internal audit, and use internal audit as part of their audit team. So it's counting as part of the auditor's own work, and that's kind of that's the part where we were placing, you know, it's so important, it's really your own work. And we think it's important enough that the auditors send and receive confirmations and evaluate those responses.
Well, Dee, I guess we've received the comment letters. We're in the process of analyzing them. Doug, thanks for your further comment today. I think to a large degree, your comment actually, I think, supports certainly one aspect that we added to the standard, which was for the auditor to confirm significant risks. And so you certainly, I think, supported the concept of a risk approach. And I think you're saying, think of our packaging. So I appreciate your comments. And I think, as was said by Jennifer, we are mindful of investors' concerns about the risk of fraud, and it's forefront on the mind of investors, and as we're writing standards, whether they be the risk assessment standards that have been adopted or other standards we're proposing, the risk of fraud is high on our list as to the procedures that we require. Dee, thanks for your presentation of the comments. We'll take all the comments we receive in the letters, obviously, into account as we think about our next steps in this regard and make a proposal to the board. We've reached that part of the meeting where the good news is I typically give a very short wrap-up, and that's I get credit for that, as everybody has their planes to make, et cetera. I want to thank everybody for their participation in this meeting. It was very lively throughout, and everybody was very actively engaged. To a large degree, I also want to attribute that to the SAG members' input to us. I reach out to SAG members before these meetings, and many of you supported the concept of
continuing the discussion around the FASB proposals, the change in the accounting framework, and the impact on the potential impact on auditing, which certainly engendered a lot of discussion at the last meeting and equally lively discussion at this meeting. And so the input I get from all of you in putting the agenda together is very valuable, and I'll certainly continue to reach out before SAG meetings to do that. I certainly can't and don't want to summarize a day and a half's worth of discussions, and since we don't ask for consensuses and vote, it's hard to do anyway. But we did hear a number of, I think, important things that I take away. On Dan talked yesterday morning about the legislation that we're asking for to fix the fact that our enforcement actions are currently private, and I certainly think there was a lot of support for that proposal, and I think everybody felt that was extremely important. The other matter that Dan talked about on uninspected firms, a number of people addressed that at the meeting and otherwise talked to me even later on about things that we could do regarding a greater disclosure of that issue, whether it be through audit reports or whatever it might be, is a really important issue. So we've taken that away. With respect to the standard-setting agenda that I spent some time on yesterday morning, I think I got a response that it was a robust yet appropriate agenda. But some items came up from others, such as SAS 70, for us to think about. The subject of transparency reporting came up as part of that. And while I mentioned independence was not on the agenda, some said we're glad to know that it's on our radar, even though it's not on the agenda yet, because maybe it should be. On the quality control standards, I think it was a very good discussion, and I think we got a lot of support for the fact that we need to put a concept release out or a document out of some type, as everybody feels the importance of quality controls to good audits and good audit practice. So we got a lot of good input yesterday afternoon on thoughts about quality control from tone on the top, culture on downwards, and that was very valuable input to us. And again, I just want to repeat one more time the conversation today on the auditability issues raised by the changes in the framework. Was a very helpful dialogue, and it reinforces the need on the part of my office to continue to talk to the FASB about developments and the SEC developments in this area as we consider auditing standards in this environment. I have no further comments to make other than to say thank you and meeting adjourned, unless, Dan, you have any comments you'd like to make.
No, I'll just join you in thanking everyone for their participation and look forward to seeing you at the next meeting.
Good. Thank you very much.